Hi everyone, welcome to the Tech Entrepreneur on a Mission podcast. My name is Ton Dobbe and I'm the founder of Value Inspiration and the author of The Remarkable Effect. I envision a world where every B2B SaaS startup succeeds because they're creating software that customers would miss if they were gone. And here's why. Research consistently shows that 90% of all startups fail, and that's bad. What's worse, however, is that 75% of SaaS scale-ups fail, companies that are supposed to have product market fit. Far too few scale-ups create the traction they aspire for and fail for the wrong reasons. And I believe this should stop, and hence I created my business. And the goal that I have with this podcast is twofold. First, to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential that we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. Secondly, share experiences from tech entrepreneurs like you about what it requires to create a remarkable software business and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so. The guest of our podcast is Sharad Puttaraju, CEO of Unicode.
It's important to love your product, but it's even more important to be obsessed about the problem that you're trying to solve. Because if you don't obsess about the problem, eventually you'll just fall in love with your product and lose your focus or vision.
This is Sharad. He's a serial entrepreneur with 15 years of experience. He navigated through a decade of ventures that didn't scale before founding Unicode in 2019. His company has since grown to serve over 50,000 businesses worldwide, including Fortune 500 companies, by creating innovative technology that connects the digital and physical worlds through mobile experiences. What makes Sharad's story remarkable is his methodological approach to business building, where he combines weekly deeply strategic thinking with rapid experimentation frameworks, always maintaining that impact, both for employees and customers, is what drives his entrepreneurial energy. And this inspired me, and hence I invited Sharad to my podcast. We explore how decades of failure can become the foundation for remarkable success. Sharad challenges conventional wisdom by dedicating specific time each Wednesday for deep thinking about long-term strategy while handling day-to-day operations. He reveals why being selective about advice is crucial for maintaining entrepreneurial confidence, and how balancing luck with persistence creates the conditions for breakthrough success. His approach makes products that simple for users while sticking to strict testing methods to know what works. By listening to this podcast, you will learn four things. Firstly, why entrepreneurial success typically takes a decade, not overnight, and how to mentally prepare for this reality. Secondly, how to implement a Wednesday deep thinking practice that balances long-term vision with short-term execution. Thirdly, the secret to filtering advice from well-meaning investors, mentors, and colleagues without losing your entrepreneurial confidence. And lastly, how to create frameworks for experimentation that prevent chaos while maximizing learning. Well, hi, Sharad. Thank you for making the time available today and being the guest on the podcast.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me, Ton, and excited to talk to you.
Yeah, well, it's a pleasure. Realizing you're dialing in today from India, and it's late in the evening, so kudos for that. It's real. Before we start talking about your company that you started in, from what I saw, August 2019, yeah. Your company Unicode. A little bit about you. What drives you, and what gives you energy as an entrepreneur?
I think what drives me is the power and the excitement that I can create a small, sizable impact on a day-to-day basis. That's really excites me. I think what keeps me going as an entrepreneur is just that same feeling of creating impact. And the way I kind of measure that is twofold, is basically the colleagues or the employees that work in the company and collaborating with them, getting something done every day. And the second thing is also through the lens of our customers. Every time we talk about this customer that we won, or how the customer has essentially implemented our product and the kind of impact or value that we've been able to add to them, that gives me a tremendous sense of excitement and makes it all feel worth it.
So good. Yeah, I completely agree with that. It's what it's all about, you know, and you do it for the right reasons. It's the customer value. Measure your impact by, or how, measure your success by how much impact you help your customers create. And if you do that right and do that well, your team will be excited about it as well. And every day something else will happen. Yeah, that's
Absolutely.
also what I see all the time. So yeah, nice bridge to your company, Unicode. You founded that in August 2019. It says on LinkedIn.
That's correct.
What is the big idea, or what was the big idea behind the company? What was the problem that was screaming for, yeah, something new?
So I think just before I kind of explain about Unicode, maybe I'll take a step back and talk about my entrepreneurial journey, which is about 15 years old. I think even before I started Unicode for about a decade, me and my co-founders ran a different company called Mobstack and built different products, which really kind of did not scale or did not kind of hit the elusive product market fit. So I learned a thing or two about failure and learned a lot about how you essentially build scalable products. Our learnings over the decade of failing over and over and over again is what kind of we poured into Unicode and which where it stands right now. And I think there are a few learnings that came along in the way. And one of the big learnings that we had was it's important to love your product, but it's even more important to be obsessed about the problem that you're trying to solve. Because if you don't so obsess about the problem, eventually you'll just fall in love with your product and lose your focus or vision. So I think the way to define Unicode is with the core fundamental problem that we're trying to solve, which is we believe that there needs to be a more effective way to connect the physical and digital world. Having built all our products in the mobile space and having understood how the mobile evolves itself, our realization is that the mobile will continue to play a very critical role in connecting the physical and digital worlds, and mobile will become the center of your physical world. So what we essentially did or started with is basically creating a platform that takes technologies like QR codes, NFC, Bluetooth, geofencing, et cetera, all the technologies that are there in a mobile device, and kind of build it into one product or one stack. And basically said, hey, brands and businesses can use any of these technologies depending on the need or the use case that they have. So multitude of reasons, including obviously the pandemic and the fact that the operating systems made the QR code scanning native to the operating system. QR
Yeah.
codes as a technology really took off. There was a kind of a renaissance where as you know, QR codes as technology has been there for more than 30 years, but it just really took off in a very big way. And we are at the right place at the right time, and we double-clicked on it, kind of built all the momentum that we needed and moved in the right direction. And that's how we've gotten this far.
Right. Yeah, I mean, August 19 is like 6, 7 months before COVID, where it really took off
Yeah.
for reasons that maybe no one could have expected, but it
That's
happened.
right. Yes.
I can remember also when I was going to places that, you know, the menu wasn't available in physical format anymore, and it was a QR code. It became a QR code. So that's definitely the case. But what is then the what are the typical problems that companies face when that digital and physical world are not connected?
I think there are two broad buckets that we see. I mean, there are multiple use cases. The exciting thing about what we are essentially trying to do is we are creating or co-creating a new vertical, right? QR code marketing, QR code management is not something that existed as has been existing. It's something that's just been, and we are kind of co-creating this new vertical. And before I kind of explain to you what the specific problems we're trying to solve, it's a little bit like the analogy that I give, which is about email marketing, right? If you think about email marketing and if you rewind yourselves back to 10, 15, even 20 years ago, email was just a personal communication tool. It just existed so that we could message, communicate with our loved ones. But from there, it converted into a powerful channel of engagement. And how did that go about? It was done because platforms like MailChimp and SendGrid and all these other ActiveCampaign, all these other very robust mail SaaS platforms came about and helped brands and businesses to convert email into a powerful communication channel. That's really what we've been doing with QR codes, right? QR codes have been around for a very long time and people understand what QR codes really do, but people didn't realize the value and the power of what QR codes can deliver. And what we essentially did or went about doing is basically explain to them that, hey, QR codes can solve a pretty big need. You can create what are called dynamic QR codes. You can gather analytics. You can collect first-party data. You can connect. You can do a handshake between digital and physical. So that's how we went about doing it, and that's the traction we've seen. So very specifically coming back to your question, there are two broad use cases that we see. One is around digitization, right? Wherever there is physical paper being involved, can you replace that with a QR code? QR codes are emerging, like to say, a call to action for the physical world. Just what a URL served in the digital world, when you click on it, it takes you to a destination to serve very different needs. The QR code is serving like the call to action in the physical world. So it could be a business card, it could be a warranty card, it could be a menu, it could be some marketing collateral, it could be a floor plan in an open house to show an apartment. Anywhere and everywhere where physical paper is being given is being replaced by a QR code. That's one broad bucket, and it depends on what people use it for. Different industries have been coming up with different use cases in that bucket. The second big bucket is just around sales and marketing, right? Now you have the ability to convert packaged products into channels of advertising, right? Imagine you have a bottle of water, you put a QR code on it, you scan the QR code. Even depending on the time of the day of the week, you can change, direct, redirect them into different places. You won't know it's Sharath who's basically scanned the specific QR code on this bottle of water, but you know that this particular device essentially scanned this QR code. So I can drop a pixel, I can drop a cookie, and I can retarget you online. So if you put a QR code on Starbucks and you scan that QR code, I will know that you scanned that particular product in this particular airport, and I can essentially retarget you with the same product online. And that's how you're kind of building a cohort of digital customers or prospects based on interactions in the physical world. And that's the larger second set of use cases that we see. Of course, there's a huge long tail of interesting use cases that we see every day, which is hard to describe in one call because every day we see interesting use cases. And that's one of the most exciting things about my job, which is I look up and see what have I learned today? How are people uniquely trying to use QR codes?
Imagine, yeah, it's about creativity that people have to put that emotion. Exactly. So,
Correct.
what is, I mean, QR codes have been around for decades. You started the business in 2019. With all the technologies available, what was an early decision that you took that appears to be really important for where you stand today?
I think we really took the route of driving the entire growth through product-led growth. So what we meant is instead of basically going directly and trying to sell in the traditional like sales way, where you just take sales guys to do, we basically said we'll make the product so extraordinarily simple that people can just sign up for our product without the need for anybody actually explaining it, make it extraordinarily intuitive and obvious, and be able to drive it and sign up for themselves and start using it. That drove a humongous amount of signups and usage, and that organic inbound traffic is what basically drove a significant amount of our usage. And that's kind of what has kept us, I think, is the first and big strategic decision that we made that helped us significantly grow very fast.
Yeah, it's always this this balance, right? What are you going to bet on? Because people think, I actually had the writer of the book PLG Growth on my podcast, and yeah, we had a discussion about the differences between sales-led growth, product-led growth, where people always think that product-led growth is more the simpler way. Well, it is over time if you get it right. You know, it's sales that grows easy to start, harder to scale, and the other way is the opposite is true for PLG. So yeah, it's about this getting it right. So I mean, it's impressive what you've done so far. What I've read online is that you've got in the meantime over 50,000 businesses worldwide, including many Fortune 500s. So it definitely worked. That was one thing. On that journey to get PLG right, what has been a very hard nut to crack on that process that eventually you cracked. What have you learned from that?
I think it's a bit of a journey, to be honest. I think it's very hard to say that we have completely cracked it because Obviously, there is a certain continuous evolution in terms of, how our onboarding has to work. But I think one of the learnings that I have had is that it's really important to kind of, when you start having a very high velocity of signups that we have thousands of prospective customers or what we call signups every day that are happening, right? The thousands of them. And it's really important for you to, given the amount of data that we essentially get from this, it is really crucial for you to prioritize on which way the product has to be directed and which way the marketing and sales efforts have to be directed. If you are basically going outbound, very sales-led, it's very natural to select one because you cannot clearly go in 20 different directions. But with product-led growth, what really happens is that you have this gust of hundreds of customers and hundreds of signups coming from different directions. So you have to be able to observe that data very closely and ask yourself the question, where is that that I want to double click on? Where can I build more product depth? Where do you think I need to start investing in product marketing? Because the answer never is in all directions, right? It never can happen like that. So especially when it's not resource intensive in the early days, it's still important to kind of keep your eyes and ears very close to that very strong funnel that you have and ask yourselves, where can I make these small tweaks that can start delivering better results? My conversion is 2%. Can I make it 2.1? Can I make it 2.5? Can I make it 3%? And to be able to make that, you still have to ask those hard questions, which you would anyway do if you are running a sales-led growth motion, because in sales, you have four sales guys. You need to focus where will you get the best ROI. But when in PLG, there is a tendency to kind of think, okay, you know what? Everything is working. All money is green. Let's do this. Let's do this. Let's do this. And let's do that. And as you know, as a seasoned operator, that never is a good idea for anything.
Yeah. So, what have you done differently in that respect? Because indeed, it's you can of course do more multiple experiments. Do you run experiments for a certain amount of time and forget it, and then purely focus on that? Because I heard that motion. Do you have a foundation and try four or five different things at the same time? I mean, how do you go about it?
I think there are two or three different aspects to it. One is basically letting one of the core decisions that we made early on is to have product drive pricing. So that keeps you very honest. Our product team really drives my co-founder who leads all the product strategy. He is involved. He takes inputs from sales, he takes inputs from growth, et cetera, but he decides pricing. That really helps the product also be very honest in terms of how to kind of drive. The second thing that's really important is that I think we have done pretty well is the fact that when it comes to experimentation, there has to be a methodology to how do you do experimentation. You cannot do more than one experiment at the same time because you won't know where the results come from. Second is there are certain times if there is a certain quantum of time that you have to decide as to how long this experiment should run. Sometimes some things take time. Sometimes the certain things have seasonality. How do you decide what and how and when should you take these to make these changes? That's really, really crucial. I think we've done a really good job on these two fronts, which is we've optimized, built good pricing strategies, mapped product and pricing in a very effective manner. And the second thing that we have done quite well is building a culture of experimentation, but at the same time, seeing that the experimentation doesn't become so overwhelming that we don't lose track of what experiments are leading what kind of growth.
Let me make a small interruption here. Chirant made an excellent remark that sets his approach apart from typical growth strategies. The realization is not about trying everything at once, but about deliberate experimentation with clear methodology. That change not only leads to measurable, trackable growth, but also builds organizational discipline that prevents the chaos typical for early stage companies. It's a trait remarkable SaaS companies master. First, they focus on the essence. Chirant demonstrates this by running controlled experiments one at a time rather than pursuing every direction simultaneously. Secondly, they master the art of curiosity. His framework for experimentation allows him to read market signals better than competitors by clearly identifying what works. And lastly, they aim to be different, not just better. By letting product drive pricing, Rather than following traditional sales-led approaches, he plays by his own rules. And you can master these traits as well. And the first step? Simply read my book. I've made the electronic version available for free. Just visit theremarkableeffect.com to grab your copy, and inspiration will spark within 10 minutes. Back to the interview. Yeah, smart. Yeah, exactly. Have you got a framework for that? That people come to own, and that they can actually make their own decisions? Because I'm not sure how big a company currently is, the number of employees. From what I saw,
A little over 100. Yeah, it's not very big. Yeah. It's just over 100 employees. But
100 is 100, right?
Yeah, that's true. It's very, I mean, it's hard for me to think about, is there a specific framework? I think there is, if I have to put my mind to it, but it'll be hard for me to articulate right now. And this is exactly a mental model on how we kind of make decisions. But I think now that you've asked me to, I should sit down and think about it and see if that makes sense.
Yeah, well, maybe you're already living it without even realizing it, but it's powerful at the end. Couple of questions around that. In that market, first of all, you said we're creating a new vertical. So that is like creating a new category.
Mm-hmm.
How have you overcome that obstacle? Because the dream is always everybody wants to create their own category. What they don't realize is that no one knows the category, no one is asking for it, and therefore no one cares. How have you overcome that hurdle to get that demand going?
I think there are two different ways to do that. One is basically a very top-down approach, which is essentially you are a big brand or you want to create a big brand, you create a big splash, you spend millions of dollars, and you basically say, hey, pay attention to me. Here is a new product. Here is a new value proposition. Upsell that value and explain and create. And that's one way to do it. If you're an early stage growth stage company like ours, you obviously don't have that kind of capital. The second way to do that is a more bottom-up way of doing it, which is you don't talk about it, even though I am articulating this as a category creator. The end customer who might be thinking about it or asking for it is not thinking about it as a category. He or she is thinking about it as there is a specific job to be done, and what I call a jobs to be done framework, which is you are in the market to do something very specific or very tactical. How do you basically address that tactical need and essentially aggregate or accumulate hundreds and thousands of people who are essentially looking to create a solution for a specific problem that they have? Once you create a certain pull or an inbound channel for you to be able to kind of attack that jobs to be done, that creates a certain groundswell, certain viralities, certain word of mouth that starts making you realize and make your brand stand out. That's how we've been able to build Unicode, which is very grounds up. We start focusing on very specific search keywords and phrases and keywords where we were able to identify and say, this is a solution that we have seen. And it's an interesting loop where as you see and learn from what people are doing, you write more content on that. As you write more content, you will get more users, which are basically coming into the same thing. And as they come in, you start educating them on what else people are doing in your vertical that you can put into that drives more expansion and more use cases. And that cycle goes on and on. And you write more content on that. And that's really how you kind of build that foundation, very bottom up.
Yeah, and very content driven as well, which is, what other companies have done tremendously well. I mean, names like, for example, Zapier, which is also something like that. You can do anything with it. And it's all about sparking that creativity. But being found is the first thing at the end.
Absolutely.
Talking about it, I mean, I wrote a lot of essays where I touch upon how difficult it is to make these things predictable. And particularly, of course, in a PLG growth mode where advertising is not the way to go. Because it is at the end, it's expensive. Unless you have this motion going that for every dollar that you spend, you get 10 customers. What have you done that at the end made it predictable?
Are you saying predictable in terms of growth, predictable in terms of customer retention?
At the end, it's a combination of those things, but particularly the predictability of what's coming in as growth, as the right growth.
I think that Interestingly, we are a very product-led inbound growth motion. A lot of it has been built on the backbone of content and SEO, and it is amazing how predictable it is, in the sense that the amount of people who search on a monthly basis is pretty similar. Of course, there's some element of seasonality to it, but invariably that there is a certain the funnel holds pretty well. There is a certain percentage of people who convert from traffic to trials. There's a certain number of people who convert from trial to customer. I think the predictability automatically fits in. What you need is essentially have those benchmarks, and what we do is we create these benchmarks on a quarter-on-quarter basis and say this is our benchmark. So say 2% is our conversion. Can we make this conversion from 2 to 2.5%? And we then create OKRs specifically for that and say here are 3 or 4 or 5 things we have to do to increase it from 2 to 2.5% and start investing on those. So we have benchmarks on each of these places. The predictability comes from understanding what your growth levers are and then just obsessing about those growth levers and leaving the rest of them out.
Yeah, exactly. How important is niching down in this respect? Have you found niches, segments of the market that where you're the problem that you solve is one more valuable and more critical than for other use cases?
Yeah, it does. I definitely it does. I think it's very interesting because without taking specific names, I think we have realized that there is an ICP, like an ideal customer profile of customers where it's easy for the sales guys to sell into, right? But because there's typically just one decision maker and they get a pretty higher average selling price. But a year later, we've also realized that this is the cohort of people who tend to churn a lot because there is just one single stakeholder who is interested, and he or she is not doing enough to kind of promote QR codes, for example, inside the customer base. Whereas we have a similar, in the same industries, we have a different customer profile where it's harder to sell, might be potentially smaller ACVs. Takes a little longer to sell, but do phenomenally well over 2 years or 3 years because they start small. There are more stakeholders involved in selling it. They want to be able to learn and educate themselves before they make a decision. They will usually take a much smaller starting point, and then our customer success team can work on them and continue to grow that account. That is the balance that you need to draw about, which is sometimes just getting started is easy. So if you start optimizing on that use case, you'll just have a very leaky bucket.
Completely agree. You say the right thing. Yeah, it's if it's easy to sell, it doesn't mean that the people stay around. It needs to your point earlier, it's not about the product, it's about the problem. And particularly also how it then sticks internally. Because if it's only based on one person, it's going to be very weaky.
Absolutely.
But you mentioned the word sales a couple of times. Does it also mean that from the PLG, that motion that you started, also have a sales motion?
Yeah, absolutely. We have a fantastic sales team based out of New York. And what we essentially do is, depending on product-led growth or depending on large enterprises, if they need to be able to use us, then we have our sales team kind of reach out to them. And we have what are called product qualified leads. So either they reach out to us use on the dashboard or on the website saying, hey, I want to talk to someone, I have specific needs, or I have a much larger need. Or we have product qualified leads, which is based on their usage patterns. We have models that predict saying, here is a person that might be worthwhile talking to because we see that other customers who have done something similar would be interested in upgrading themselves to a much larger tier or to an enterprise plan. And so those are the ones which our sales team handles.
Yeah, exactly. Which is, of course, very typical because at the end it needs to be about larger deal sizes. Well, how do
Correct.
you see that evolve, by the way? Do you see that the bigger percentage will continue to come from PLG, or do you think over time it will start to switch to sales-led growth?
I think as you grow bigger, the world of SaaS will teach you that you need to sell higher ACVs just to be able to grow faster and faster, only because for the same percentage of growth, your base is much bigger. So to be able to move the needle, you need bigger ACVs. But it's that is traditional thought process. I kind of broadly agree with it, but I sometimes want to push back and see, can you sell more of smaller ACVs and still be able to make up for that growth? So I'm kind of in between there. I think there is an opportunity to obviously grow or increase your ACV. But if you're a category creator, if you're someone who's coming and creating a new category, there is a lot of education that you have to do with respect to the market, which essentially means you have a greenfield opportunity to go and conquer a market which has just come about into existence. So it's okay to sell smaller ticketed ACVs, and it's okay for you to wait a little longer as the market really grows itself into larger ACVs. So it's worth the wait.
That is for sure true. I'm always kind of time testing what work, and I think it's also depending on the product. I mean, if you have a product that is also increasing in complexity, of course, then it will more swing towards sales-led growth. But the moment it stays like relatively, simple between air quotes.
I think I also think that the reality is that if you look at software as a service in general, most enterprise versions of current platforms are typically the core value proposition is never that different from a self-service to an enterprise product. What really comes about in an enterprise product is security, single sign-on, reports, authentication, the ability to create organizations, the ability to create multi-factor authentication. Those are things that make a difference. People want to pay for that. And the reality is the core use case of a large Fortune 100 customer and a small business down the street, the use cases might be pretty similar, but the way a large enterprise adopts the software is very different. And people pay for that rather than the core value proposition itself.
Funny, yeah. Yeah, it's
Yeah.
crazy. Control kicks in, and I can see, I can understand it. I don't agree necessarily that the value is bigger in that particular area, but that's a completely different thing. It is maybe table
Correct.
stakes in order to get in
Yeah.
and to stay there.
That's true.
So, in terms of scaling the company, and maybe looking at what you're doing right now with Unicode versus the company that you used to run, Mobstack, what lessons have you learned around scaling the company that you, possibly wish to know before?
Oh, so many.
What is one
I
that
don't know.
sticks out?
One that sticks out. Wow. I mean, it's a lot around hiring. Be very deliberate about the way you hire. I think I recently wrote a LinkedIn post about it. I think one of the biggest learnings I've had is at the end of the day, as an entrepreneur, you're given lots and lots of advice from lots and lots of well-meaning people, you know? Your leaders, your investors, your board, your mentors every day. But the reality is, at the end of the day, it's most of the advice, even though it's well-meaning, is reasonably cookie cutter in the sense that most people are reflecting from their own experience. So it's really important, and I think the hardest job as a CEO or a founder is to be able to differentiate between advice that you should follow and advice that you should just ignore. Because at the end of the day, this is your journey and you
True.
need to make it most meaningful to yourself. And I think that is extraordinarily hard. Because what happens a lot of times is that I'm a person who believes that good advice can come from anywhere. I am just generally very responsive. Good ideas can come from anyone. So I listen to a lot of people, but I might not listen, agree with, or actually implement most of it. But if you just keep listening to a lot of general advice on a day-to-day basis, it starts denting your own confidence. And that's happened over the years to me, where I would just listen to anybody's advice, and most people give advices from their own biases. So it's important for you to say, no, this is not worth my time. That is a very hard job. And if there's a way you can do it, and if there's a framework to decide whether you should accept someone's advice or not, I would love to hear. But if there's anything I would say to another entrepreneur, it is take advice from people with any advice, anyone, even your family, friends, take it with a pinch of salt, because
Yeah.
honestly, you are in the hot seat and you're the only one who will be able to decide that.
Why are you talking about hot seat? I mean, I run a mastermind with people like you on a weekly basis, and that is always one thing that helps, you know, to be surrounded with peers, not other people. You know, an investor is another person with another agenda,
Correct.
but the peers are on the same level, have the same problem. But if they're not in your company, they don't at least see your problem the way you see it. And I think that is a really helpful thing, to surround yourself with peers that are, yeah, having
100%.
this. And then, like you say, take it with a grain of salt, and yeah, reflect on it and connect the dots that are important to yourself. That's
That's
absolutely
true.
critical. I saw from my research about you that you're a long-term thinker and a short-term actor, and I always admire that, because a lot of companies get just kind of ingrained into the vicious cycle of short-term. How do you do that? What can others learn from that approach? And yeah, possibly, how do you go about it on a day-to-day basis?
I think the way I do this is that, for example, on Wednesdays is a no meeting day for me. And what I do on Wednesdays, every Wednesday, is I just think about the long term. I think about I do deep thinking. And deep thinking is generally, what I mean by that is I think about problems that potentially are on the horizon or my biggest problem today. And I can just sit on it, because anything long term needs time for you to get into the problem. It takes a few hours to get in and a few hours to get out. It does not happen on a day-to-day basis. So if you kind of allocate a certain specific amount of time undisturbed, with your Slack off, with your email off, with your phone notifications away, and spend some time, it's a little bit like meditation, you know? You kind of wrestle with the problem or a challenge. And many times, you might not have a solution, but you will be able to define the problem more accurately. And being able to articulate that better to yourself itself is half the conquest. And so that really helps me. So if you take 5 working days, I mean, Saturday and Sunday, obviously you end up working because you're an entrepreneur. But if you take 5 full working days, 4 of those go into tactical, everyday firefighting, helping your leaders do what's necessary to achieve that goal, etc. But
Yeah.
every Wednesday, I spend a lot of time thinking about the bigger thing. And that really helps me kind of marry them. Many times when you are basically spending time in the middle of every week to think about the horizon, it helps you make faster, more sensible decisions on a day-to-day basis, and what should you be doing this week, next week, etc. And that's really how I do it.
So deliberately also Wednesday. I like that,
Yeah.
because I have that on Monday, and I think Wednesday would serve me better. So I'm going to steal this from you.
That's awesome. I'm glad. Yeah, Mondays are like firefighting, because there is so much that would have happened. Everybody has questions to ask. It's a new week, etc. I've seen Mondays and Tuesdays are the busiest days of the week for me.
Yeah, that's
So,
true.
and
Yeah.
Wednesday, it also seems like it's the middle of the week. It's the hump day. So a little slower in pace really helps. So I have a very standard schedule on Wednesdays in the morning. I have breakfast, I have a coffee, then sit down. I start scribbling on the on I used to write it in a book. Now I write on my iPad on, okay, what are the 3 problems, and then start going into it.
Very good. Well, thanks for sharing that. Looking at the time, by the way, let me see. There's one question that you said something around hiring, and of course, you've grown over the last 5, 6 years to well beyond 100. One metric that I've come to value a lot the last 2, 3 years, because it says so much about leverage, is ARR per employee. Are you following that as a metric as well?
Yes, we do. And we're in a pretty good place. It's I can't tell you exactly what the number is, but that's something that we really obsess about, because I think that gives you a sense of how functionally good we are and how effective we are with the amount of money that we're really spending.
Exactly. Yeah. You can grow fast and you can double employees every single year, but you can be in a terrible place as
Yeah.
a consequence of that.
Correct.
So ARR per employee is just super honest on that.
Yeah.
Let me see. Yeah, I mean, last question. Out of all the wisdom that you've gained over the last, I think you said 15 years of entrepreneurship. What would be a don't and what would be a do that you'd like to share with other entrepreneurs that are on a similar journey?
Don't jump in to entrepreneurship assuming a quick win. I think the stories that are told of entrepreneurs who are extraordinarily successful, those are very rare. Most entrepreneurial journeys take 10 years before getting any element of success. That's par for the course. The ones which created something and hit a home run the next day are very far and few, even though they might be spoken a lot more in media. So do it for the right reasons. Be in it for the long and play the long game. Eventually, it'll start panning out. And the second thing I would say, and partly is that there's a huge element of luck that also always plays a role. I think every entrepreneur will tell you how much luck has played a role in their lives. But it's very hard to say whether it's luck or your hard work that's helped you achieve whatever you have. So you've got to be mindful of both and just keep doing what you're doing, and not question either or, because you require a little bit of both to hit any kind of escape velocity. So
Exactly.
those are my two
Yeah.
cents.
Perfect. Thank you very much for sharing this. Where can people go to find out more about Unicode or to say hi to you?
I think unicode.com, UNIQODE, as the logo says on my Zoom background. I'm charlotte@unicode.com. Please feel free to reach out to me in email if you have specific founder-related questions. I write quite frequently on LinkedIn right now. That's been my 2025 resolution. So I've been speaking and talking a lot. So please follow me on LinkedIn. I'm sure you'll find some interesting nuggets like the ones I've shared for the last
Good.
30 minutes.
Yeah, perfect. We're
It's
glad
awesome.
that you started writing for LinkedIn as well. I do the same. It's
Awesome.
it makes a difference. Thank you very much. It was a pleasure speaking to you.
Likewise, thank you so much for having me.
And this ends my conversation with Sharad. And I hope you enjoyed it. And if so, please leave a review on iTunes. And if it inspired you, please share it with other tech entrepreneurs on a mission that you have in your network. Other than that, thank you for tuning into this podcast. I had the honor to speak to Sharad Potaraciu, CEO of Unicode. As said, the goal that I have in this podcast is twofold. Firstly, to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. And secondly, share experiences from tech entrepreneurs like you about what is required to create a remarkable software business and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so. Before I close, I have two more comments to make. If you know other tech entrepreneurs on a mission that have a story worth sharing, please send me an email at ton.dobby@valueinspiration.com. Building the momentum all starts with revealing the ideas, and that starts with you. And if you want to know more about my book, or you're interested in joining the Remarkable Effect tribe, please visit my website at www.valueinspiration.com. Thanks for tuning in. And you could do me a big favor by rating the podcast on iTunes or provide me with your feedback directly. I'll see you shortly on a new episode.